clicker works and all that. I never trust in technology. That's a terrible thing. Oh, well, I have been looking forward to being able to come and be with you over this weekend. Although I am not an expert on parenting, I don't pass myself off as an expert. I think people find out I've had 10 kids. They know I've made more mistakes than anyone else, probably. Actually, we're adopting our 11th child currently, so we just don't know when to quit. And parenting, I think, is a very important topic because the home is the foundation of everything. We have evidence all around us of the breakdown of society and of children who don't have very good relationship with their parents and vice versa. Now, as far as Christians are concerned, I think we all make mistakes, and they don't necessarily have to be catastrophic mistakes. Just one mistake you make is just the end of the world. Now, there are obviously some mistakes you could make that are so severe they could be that way, but for most Christians, that's not where we find ourselves. And I'm certain there is no such thing as a perfect parent out there. And so our kids may, as it turns out, turn out okay, even if we don't do a very good job or as good as we can. But think of all the suffering we go through in the meanwhile. Think of all the suffering the people around us go through. I've known lots of parents who didn't follow a lot of the suggestions I would make, for example, that we're going to cover in this series. And yet their kids have turned out quite well, and they are well-adjusted adults, and they're very godly, good Christians. But along the way, over 18 years of growing, their parents certainly could have saved themselves a lot of misery as well. And so what I'm saying is we have failure, certainly, which we want to avoid, and then we have the ideal that we want to pursue. And all of us are probably going to fall somewhere in between, or most of us will fall somewhere in between. But the closer we can get to the ideal, the better off that will be for us. And of course, because we're dealing with people, we have no guarantees. There's no guarantee if you study the gospel with somebody that they're going to be converted. There's no guarantee because you marry a particular person that they're going to be faithful. There's no guarantee because you teach your child faithfully that they will automatically, magically turn out a certain way. That's just the nature of unique individuals, and we all have free choice, and we can choose poorly. You remember who the first father was? Kind of a trick question. First father was not Adam. Who was it? God. How did things turn out for the first father? Well, his children had choice, and they made a poor choice. And so if God can't just magically force, I guess he could, but he's not going to, force us all to turn out right, we know we don't have that option as well with our children. Well, there's a lot of stuff floating around out there about parenting. You can go to any bookstore and buy all kinds of books on parenting, some of which is a bunch of nonsense, some of which is compatible with what the Bible teaches. There are a lot of particulars about parenting the Bible does not tell us. You know, you might have a question, how do I get my little child to eat broccoli? Well, I don't know of any book, chapter, or verse that tells us how to get our children to eat broccoli. And there's a lot of little particulars like that. And you're going to probably, even within any church of godly Christian people, may get lots of different pieces of advice about how they would handle those particular situations. But what we can do is start with what we know for certain. That's always a good place to begin when there's any uncertainty or any gray areas out there. Start with what we know. Have a very solid foundation from which to proceed. And that's really the purpose of our session to begin with here, is to kind of have a big picture about what parenting is about. I'm going to rely upon the fact that you're probably familiar with a lot of the basic teaching in the Bible, that parents should teach their children, that children are to be obedient to their parents, the fifth commandment to honor your father and your mother. There's a lot of those kind of passages we are familiar with. And if we can kind of put those together in such a way that give us a good, solid picture, a big picture of how things are supposed to be, then all the little pieces will know that they need to fit inside this big picture somehow. You know, it's kind of like putting a puzzle together. And if we have the picture on the box and we know what it's supposed to look like, and then we've got all the little pieces and we can figure out then where does this little piece go? How does it fit into the big scheme of things? And so if we start with what we know, then we'll be much better off. And this will give us some basis to proceed to discuss all the little particulars and details about parenting. Now, the problem is, using our illustration of a puzzle, you ever try to put a puzzle together and you had a piece and you didn't know where it went? And then you got to the end of the puzzle, the whole puzzle's put together and you still had that piece? Because it's not from that puzzle. Someone's been messing with your puzzle and putting the wrong puzzles, pieces from different puzzles in your box. Well, that's what the devil does. You know, he messes around with our puzzle pieces and he dumps some in there in the mix. And so we'll get some piece of advice and we'll start to try to put it in the picture and we'll find it doesn't really fit. If we have a real good idea of what this puzzle's supposed to look like or what the big picture's supposed to look like, then we'll be able to identify what are the true pieces that fit in there and where they fit, and what are the bad pieces that don't really fit into the puzzle. So, before we actually launch into our session, I think everyone's got a handout that this first session, it's basically a skeleton outline of where we're going. Some things maybe you can fill in along the way that just maybe thinking about as we start to get there, you know, help you stay awake here in the afternoon or something. And it'll be something you can have to help you as kind of notes as we go along and to have with you to take home. But a couple things I want to say before we actually started looking at Psalm 127, for example, and that is that there are a number of challenges to giving advice to people about parenting or studying about parenting and making application in our own situation. The first thing is all of us as parents are somewhat defensive. You know, I learned this a long time ago. You can say almost anything to a brother or sister in Christ. You can be pretty blunt about things. Hey, what you said was very unkind. You shouldn't have said that. And they can accept that kind of criticism, you know, graciously and move on. But about the last thing you can say to somebody is, your kid's rotten. You know, that's about the one thing they're most sensitive about. You can say their cooking's bad, their spouse is bad, and so on and so forth. But you say their kids are bad, and you've really hit a nerve. And we don't even have to say things to one another. I might just know I'm a little sensitive about, you know, what do people think of my kids? I think we've all had that experience where we go out in public and behavior that our children have been doing at home that hasn't really bothered us that much, but once other people are around, then suddenly we get a little self-conscious about, well, what do people think, you know? And that's a good symptom to have because it makes us reflect, you know, should I be concerned about their behavior, whether it's at home or out in public, and maybe change and do something about that? Or does it indicate that, you know, maybe I need to back off a little bit and not be so concerned about, you know, what other people think if I'm confident that this behavior is right and good to begin with? And so I would just ask us as we begin this, I'm not here to, you know, step on anyone's toes intentionally, certainly. I don't have an agenda. I have this understanding that comes from Scripture about what parenting is about. And based upon that, I have a number of suggestions I would make to people. And it's up to you to judge whether you think those suggestions are good, whether they resonate with you or not. And I put this warning at the beginning of the session 3 material that you'll get. But any suggestion someone can make to you, there's always going to be an exception somewhere. You know, someone can always envision a situation, but wouldn't it be okay to do that in this situation? And that's fine. But you understand, I'm trying to think of what are the typical kind of scenarios that rise up And in those kinds of situations, this typical kind of behavior or this typical suggestion, I think, is something we ought to think about. And again, if it resonates with you, if you think that makes sense, then I would encourage you to consider it. If it just you think I'm, you know, off the wall, well, that's fine too. A second thing is we as parents have our own baggage from our own upbringing. Now, one of the great statements of the mercy of God in Exodus chapter 34, you may remember, the loving kindness of God is for thousands. Unfortunately, a lot of people read that to mean thousands of people, but it means the loving kindness of God is for thousands of generations. But he will visit iniquity to the third and the fourth generation. Now, I don't think by that God means that your children somehow are biologically, genetically guilty of your sin, and your grandkids are still guilty of that sin, and your great-grandkids are still guilty of that sin. It is the last of a lengthy number of things that the writer says about God's mercy. And you think about it, it is merciful that the stupid decisions I make as a parent are limited. Unlike the loving kindness of God, which will last for thousands of generations, my stupidity will not last for thousands of generations. Isn't that a mercy? But will my children be impacted by my foolishness? Yes. Will my grandchildren have to pay a little bit for the baggage I've saddled, you know, their parents with? Yes. And even to the great-grandchildren. And of course, a classic example of this in the Bible is Jehoshaphat. Remember? Now, Jehoshaphat was a good king. But because of his foolishness, all of his children died, except one. And all of his grandchildren died, except one. And all of his great-grandchildren died, except one. You talk about foolishness that lasted to the third and the fourth generation. But in God's mercy, again, it's limited. Now, of course, my children can make their own foolish choices and pass that baggage down further down the line. But in mercy, God limits my foolishness, my baggage. But we do need to be aware of the baggage we've been given by our parents or grandparents. Because the typical thing that happens is if we grew up in a home where our parents were harsh, we might react against that and say, well, I'm not going to be like that. And then we tend to be too lenient with our children. Or we may grow up in a home where our parents are very lenient, and we may say, ah, that wasn't what was for the best. And we may overreact to that and be too harsh with our children. So we need to be aware of that and try to kind of step back and objectively look at where we are as parents and proceed from there. Third problem we have to deal with is kind of worldly philosophies that are floating around out there. A lot of bad advice we may get from well-intentioned family members who may not share a biblical worldview. We may just have grown up, buying into certain assumptions of our culture, and that becomes difficult when those things are incompatible with the Bible. Fourthly, a lot of people don't understand human nature. Little babies are so sweet and cuddly and innocent, and they don't stay that way, and they turn into two-year-olds and four-year-olds and so on. But the Bible tells us in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. That is by very definition what children are. They are foolish. And our goal is to make them wise and not foolish. We're trying to train them to be adults rather than children. And so if we think the children are just inherently good and inherently just going to be compliant, and all that really takes is, you know, feeding and washing them, so they don't die, that they're pretty much going to turn out okay. No. A child left to his childishness is just going to become more, strengthened in his childishness. He's going to become more childish. And the last of all, I think, what a lot of people lack as parents is a very good idea about what parenting is all about. And that's what we're going to begin looking at then in this session. What are the goals, the goal? And if we break that goal down to sub-goals or objectives, and then what method, what one general approach to parenting that we could describe as the biblical method of parenting, if we could have a real good biblical foundation of that, I think everything else is going to fall into place much more easily. And so, we have this statement in Psalm 127. Since I took my coat off, I lost my glasses. Psalm 127, verses 3 through 5. Behold, children are a gift from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. And so the question is, do we think of our children as a gift? You know, you think about the little ones you have. Are they a reward? Are they a blessing? And you can see a lot of people read a passage like that and just shake their head. Those aren't the first words to come to mind when the, you know, Tasmanian terror comes rolling into town. The blessings at it again, causing all kinds of riot and havoc upstairs, and all the rewards, spilled all the cereal on the table, and there's the gift running up and down the aisle screaming. Well, it's times like that we wonder why we ever had kids and what did we expect was going to happen. This is the Lord's perspective. They are a gift, and we ought to think of them that way. They are to be a blessing in our life, and so when we don't feel blessed, we need to ask ourselves, why is that the case? And the answer is probably because our children are not what God would have them to be. Their relationship we're developing with them needs some work. But we do need to be reminded as well, these really are not our children. We don't possess them. We don't own them. We're just stewards. They're God's children. They're made in His image. He ultimately is their father. But He has done a wonderful thing in entrusting the most precious thing on the face of the planet, the most valuable thing that exists in creation, is the soul of a human being. And God places that soul that belongs to Him in our care, and really for a very short period of time, some 18 or 20 years, we nurture and train this soul that it can be a mature, responsible adult and do God's will. And so that brings us to what is really the one goal of biblical parenting. And this is not going to be an amazing revelation here, I don't think, to anybody. But there are basically two sides to this. Now, first of all, you want your children to be godly. If your children aren't godly, then all is lost. I mean, if they don't turn out to be righteous, to put their trust in God, to want to serve the Lord, those kinds of things, then we haven't really taught them anything that's important. We might have taught them to be lawyers or doctors or, for, 80 years or however long they live on this earth, and then what? It's all for naught. We haven't really taught them anything of eternal value. And so they need to be godly. But there's another very important dimension to this, and that is we also need to teach them to be independent. This is really the great debate that's raging between the East and the West. You know, there are a number of fanatical Islamic types for whom virtue, godliness, is the most important thing. And so if they hold a gun to your head to make you be godly, there's no problem with that because we want godliness, right? If there's a congregation, say here, wanted a 100% church attendance, easy way to do that. Just have the church buy some AK-47s, give each of the deacons one, and I guarantee you could have everybody here every time. Would it mean anything? No. Wouldn't be legal, I'm sure, too, but that's beside the point. Now, we've made people attend church, but is that the goal? Is that what we're trying to do here in this congregation? Get people to attend church? Is that the goal? No, that's not the goal. The goal is to make people followers of Jesus. And if you could get them to be following Jesus, then other things like whether they'll go to church or not, that'll take care of itself. That's part of the bigger picture. And so again, what's the goal? Well, unless virtue is freely chosen by somebody for themselves, unless our child is godly because that's their choice, not because we in some way have manipulated them or coerced them, forced them in some way to be godly, that independent aspect has to be there as well. And so to put those two together, we could say my goal is to equip my child to be independently godly. I want them to grow up to love the Lord, but that needs to be their faith, not mine. And you can see a lot of cases where parents have allowed their children to be individuals and just do their thing, and those kids don't seem to turn out to be very godly. They seem to be dominated by their impulses, their lusts and desires. They really can't say no to anything. They're just carried along by every whim that pops into their head. And so they're independent, but they're not very godly. And then you have probably known of some kids who seem very godly, but they have no independence. Maybe we've really sheltered our kids, and we didn't let them go to government schools, we didn't let them watch any TV, we didn't let them associate with any kids, we didn't let them go to any church, we did the home church thing, and so we just kept them completely isolated and sheltered from every possible evil influence we can think of, except ourselves. And what happens when they turn 18? Unless you keep them chained in the basement or something, well, a lot of them, as soon as they can leave, they're just running wild because that godliness, that appearance of godliness, never was really their own choice. And so those are two things together that we're trying to do. And so we could use the words maturity and immaturity, not, of course, in a physical sense, but spiritual maturity, spiritual immaturity. Would be one way of looking at that. But a word that the Bible uses is self-control. So this is a good Bible word that we have to describe what it is we're trying to do. It's not a word that occurs a great many times in the New Testament, but when it does, it is quite significant. Just look in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 as a good illustration of this principle. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. Well, this is a attribute that we need as Christians, self-control. We need to be godly, and we need to make that choice for ourselves. And it's not just a one-time thing, but a way of life. And Paul illustrates that here with the athletes who competed in these Olympic kind of caliber games in the ancient world. Of course, the second most important games that were held in the ancient world were held in Corinth, and they would have been very familiar with this imagery. And you talk about winning a perishable wreath. You know what the reward was for winning one of these games at Corinth? I guarantee you somebody here has it in their refrigerator. You know that bottom crisper drawer? Some withered celery. If you've got that in your refrigerator, you've got an Olympic prize right there that they would have given people at Corinth. It really was perishable. And of course, they were doing it for the fame, and that might last a little longer than the celery, but even that is fleeting. But we need this for an imperishable prize. Well, what's going to equip our children to become adults who have self-control? I mean, that's really the one word more than any other that gets at the heart of what it is to be an adult, a godly adult, an adult that is as God would have us to be. And you can see that in the word itself. The word self in self-control highlights the independent aspect of it. This is the function of self. This is the decision for self. This is what I am doing for myself. And control describes that aspect of living according to God's rules and training ourselves in this godliness that He has called us to have. And so this good biblical term, self-control, really succinctly summarizes what it is we're trying to do for our children, right? And you can contrast that, of course, with its opposite, self-indulgence, any kind of selfishness. There are a lot of self words that would fall into that category. But as we think about that goal of self-control or independent godliness, we can break this down into two further kind of subsets. Okay, I want to teach my child self-control. What does that entail in big picture terms? And these two things are wisdom. In other words, you have to teach your child something. You need to get him to understand something. And only by making a decision that is informed and acting upon that information that ultimately is revealed from God, is he really going to be able to be self-controlled. I mean, you think about the illustration of Paul here in the games. If you don't know the rules of the game, you know, what are the standards? How long is the race that I have to run in order to win this prize and so on? You have no idea what's going on. And so wisdom, that instruction, that teaching has to be part of that. And of course, that's contrasted with foolishness. Now, as Paul tells us earlier in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the world has a kind of foolishness that they think is wisdom. And in their foolishness, they think God's wisdom is foolish. So we have that kind of situation that Isaiah envisions in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20, those who call what is evil good, and those who call what is good evil. But from God's perspective and God's definition, we have His wisdom, and then we have the foolishness of the world, and the foolishness that our children are left to languish in unless they get that instruction and are taught that wisdom from God. The second thing that we have to do, because if all you do is teach your child, that's not going to accomplish our goal. We also have to give that child practice in actually implementing and doing the things that they have been taught. And so we could use the word responsibility here. Again, there's a lot of words we could use. I'm not quibbling about the terminology, but what we're talking about is we need to teach them, and then we need to give them some on-hands practice in living out what they have been taught. And the word responsible is a good word to describe that. Someone who's taking accountability for themselves and putting these things to work, and that, of course, being contrasted with a child that is irresponsible. So let's just think through this in a little bit as we kind of define our terms of what we would look at in terms of self-control. And I think in the handout I've kind of listed a number of representative types of things, and you might be able to think of some other things as well. But what exactly is self-control? What are some factors that it's going to involve that I need to be thinking about? Well, a person who is self-controlled, he's the one that's in control, then he's not being controlled by his passions, his feelings, his impulses, you know, all these just whims that come upon somebody. Someone, you know, just watches a commercial on TV for a new car, and they just, oh, I got to go get a new car. You know, they don't give any thought to it. It's just an impulse that just erupts, and then they act on it. That is not a self-controlled person. And, of course, in practical terms, we want to teach our children to guard themselves against being manipulated by the marketing world. But even more importantly, we need to teach our children to be insulated against the practices of Satan and the evil teaching that can sweep someone away. You know, I mean, if they wind up buying a car they don't really need, that's unfortunate, and it may be financially foolish, but it's not as quite as bad as making a foolish decision that has eternal consequences, right? And so if our children are just being dominated by their feelings, just every impulse that hits them, they've got to have it now, you know, they're demanding of it, well, they obviously are falling short of self-control, and we have to get them there somehow. Freedom from having to indulge themselves. Well, everybody finds ice cream appealing, or that piece of chocolate cake, and on it goes. But when we see that, do we just have to eat it? Or can we refuse to indulge ourselves? And that's just a minor example of all the various temptations that come our way. You know, every temptation is an appeal in some way, an enticement. And if we just have to indulge ourselves at everything that we're enticed by, we are going to be destroyed. And so we need to teach our children to be able to choose what is right rather than what is easy, or what is wrong, or what is merely alluring to our feelings, but what is right according to what we have been taught and what is the will of God. And if a person is self-controlled, then they're able to be more thoughtful of others. Their mind is centered upon others. How can I help other people? How can I serve them? I'm going to put myself out and do some hard work. It's not fun, but I'm going to do it for these people. It takes self-control to do that. When we're dominated by our own feelings and passions, when all we think about is what I want and what I feel, we give very little thought to other people except how we can use them in some way to further our own agenda. So, is my child self-indulgent? Well, can he tell himself no? Or does he like to hear the word no? You know, that's one of those kids real quickly find out they don't like that word no. I remember preaching in a place that had no padding on the pews, and all throughout the sermon, this kid would lay on the pew, and he would just, you know, forcefully, as much as his little legs could carry, just dig his heels into that wooden pew, and bam, 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 bam. And afterwards, the mother was a little apologetic, and she was wanting to say, well, he's teething. And I thought, well, he's pretty old to be teething, first of all. But I noticed that this child had an outbreak of teething pain every time his mother told him no. She didn't seem to draw that correlation. But it was clear to me his problem wasn't his teeth. The problem was he was hearing the word no. And he didn't like that. He didn't want to be told no. And so if our child doesn't like the word no and finds it difficult to accept the word no, that is indicative of a problem. If you have a child that thinks he's entitled to something, he deserves whatever it is he wants, why can't he have it now? He wants immediate gratification, impatient, can't even save for anything, can't wait for anything. He's focused on fun and having a good time, never interested in doing anything that, you know, service, hard work, something for somebody else. Unappreciative of gifts or food. I mean, when your child is, you know, you're invited over to somebody else's house and you're sitting there at the table, and the hostess decides to serve, I don't know, creamed spinach, whatever. And your child does not like creamed spinach. How does your child normally look at that bowl of creamed spinach? I don't like creamed spinach. I think it's disgusting. I don't want to eat it, right? A person who has been trained as a godly Christian adult, when they look at that bowl of creamed spinach, what do they think? Well, they may be thinking, I don't like creamed spinach, and it looks disgusting, and I don't want to eat it. But they're not going to say that, first of all. And that impulse is going to be quickly replaced by, I'm appreciative that this person had me over into their home, and they've put themselves out and gone to the expense of buying this food and preparing it for me and so on. And you see it for what it is. It's a gift. And you appreciate it for that, because you're thinking about the other and what it means to them, not yourself and whether you like it or not. And so it's a completely different worldview about how you evaluate things, what standard by which you judge things. And so if we're being self-indulgent, it's all about me and how I feel, then that's the standard we're going to apply. Children that are bored and discontent, it's because they are completely focused on self. If you start thinking about other people and serving them, your boredom will evaporate in an instant. And so my children learned never to say they're bored, because what I will say to them back is, so you're confessing to me that you're self-indulgently selfish and sinning. Well, it sounds a little strong, but that's kind of what it is. Now, I know a lot of times, there's times I'm not that excited about something that's going on. But again, we can always focus our mind on what is good and what is right, and what is for the good of other people, and so on. And a self-indulgent child appears to apply principles inconsistently. But there's no inconsistency. People are always consistent. So anytime you see someone who looks like they're being inconsistent, you can just go to the bank. They are being absolutely consistent. Now, usually, what they're being consistent about is just doing what they feel like. That's the consistency, my own selfish desire. And so think of a child, right? The child wants to play with the toy the other child has. And so he's a big believer in this rule that children should share their toys. I think this child should share their toy with me. That's very important. On another occasion, the child has the toy, and it's the other child that would like to share. And suddenly that rule about how children should share toys, no, this is my toy, I had it first. And you might say, well, that seems very inconsistent. You know, should we be living by this rule that we share toys, or whoever, you know, gets it first gets to keep it? Well, it's actually very consistent, because, you know, if I have the toy, I get to keep it. If I don't have the toy, I get to get it. And again, what's being consistent? It's all about me and what I want, and I want the toy, see? And adults, sadly, do not escape the same problem. Now, if you listen to that list and you say, yeah, that describes my kid all right, don't be too alarmed. That's the way kids are. They're not adults yet. They are self-indulgent. They have all of these problems. A child left to his natural devices is going to respond in exactly this way. And so to the fact that our children may still struggle with this, have degrees of this, maybe some of these worse than others, it's not the end of the world. They're a child. We can't expect them to be a perfect adult yet. But we do recognize these are things that we need to work on. These are things that need to change. That if we're going to be successful in eradicating the self-indulgence from them, we're certainly not going to do that by placating or catering to that self-indulgence. Well, what is wisdom? Well, we could use the terms understanding or insight, something like that, to describe wisdom. But some practical ways we could describe wisdom is the ability to learn from our experiences so we don't just keep repeating the same mistakes. You know, some kids just don't seem to get it. You know, you keep doing this and you keep getting this unpleasant consequence. Why do you keep doing it? Well, he may lack wisdom. He may have difficulty connecting the dots and not seeing the cause and effect that exists between his bad behavior and the consequence to it. Being able to see beyond just the surface, superficial appearance of things. Being able to make sound decisions. Again, you can look further down the road and see the consequences of a poor decision, see the consequence of a good decision, and allow that to guide you in your decision making. The ability to keep a level head is a feature of wisdom. Because again, wisdom is being guided by instruction, it's being guided by principles, it's being guided by rules, God's standards, not just an impulse and a whim. And so that gives us confidence in what we do. And this kind of wisdom, again, is only possible when we exercise self-control. It cannot be separated from self-control at all. They go hand in hand together. If, again, we're being dominated by our passions and our feelings, then all wisdom just goes out the window, and our ability to function is lost. Okay, is my child foolish instead of wise? Well, is he oblivious to future consequences of his actions? Does he, again, repeatedly commit the same offense? Can we trust him to be alone? Again, I'm not talking about a three-week-old or something like that. Does he manage his money or his time poorly? That would be indicative of foolishness, obviously. Is he impulsive? Does he retaliate in kind? You know, these are all just specific things that may be symptoms of a child, again, that is foolish. And then as we consider the idea of responsibility, very quickly, the idea of accepting personal responsibility, personal accountability. You know, how often do kids eagerly say, yes, I did that. You know, yes, I'm the one that broke the vase, right? You know, if you ever had something break around the house, and you got to go through this whole detective, you know, series of who broke the vase. I didn't do it, and all the kids, none of them did it. So I'm just constantly thinking, I guess my wife's going around breaking all this stuff because it wasn't me and wasn't any of the kids. So, no. And that's what's easy when you just have the one, you know. You see the thing broken in the living room, the dirt spilled out. And, well, I'm pretty sure I didn't do that. Joy didn't do that. Okay. But once you start having two or more, you know, unless you got, you know, surveillance constantly everywhere in your house, how are you going to figure that out? Well, how do we teach our children to take responsibility? Yeah, I did that. I was wrong. Yeah, I, you know, shouldn't have said that, and so on. Work habits that are faithful and conscientious, that, you know, you don't have to watch them constantly and, you know, keep prodding them to do what they need to be doing. He shows integrity. He's reliable. You know, says he'll be there, he'll be there. Punctual, that kind of thing. Someone who takes the initiative is a responsible person, obviously. And again, that's a feature of self-control. If your life is not under control, you're not going to be a responsible person. People are not going to be able to rely upon you. You can't even rely upon yourself. So is my child irresponsible? Well, he denies anything's ever his fault. And even if it is his fault, well, it's really somebody else's fault that it's his fault, and always trying to put the blame on somebody else. Resents punishment, thinks he's misunderstood and ill-used, and doesn't deserve his spanking or whatever. A child that's lazy, he doesn't like hard work or having to do things for other people. And so he chafes at the idea of, you know, service for others. So hopefully that's given us kind of a big picture view here of, you know, what it is we're trying to do. And that leads me then to introduce this last bit, and then we'll take a little break and come back and finish this. But if we've looked at our goal, which is to have self-control, and we break that goal down into teaching our children wisdom and giving them practice in living out a life that's responsible and doing the right and good things they ought to be doing. Well, if we are convinced that that's really what it's all about, that that really is my job as a parent, to give that kind of training to them, then the question is, what method is going to accomplish those goals or those objectives? Now again, there's lots of techniques and specifics and things like that, but we just boiled it down to what is the one basic approach we need to take to raising our children. What is it going to be? And so I would suggest this is the most helpful thing that for me. Think about it. If you're trying to teach a child self-control, you're trying to see to it he grows up into a spiritually mature, independently godly person that we could say possesses self-control. Think of the significance of that. Because what a lot of parents think is, I want my kid to be good. And in specifics, it might be like, hey, I want the trash out, or I want the yard mowed. And so if the kid takes the trash out, check it off. I did that. Good parent. I got the yard mowed, you know, got the kid to do it. So check that off. Good parent. Well, but if that's not really the goal, then I haven't accomplished my job as a parent. And so likewise here at the church, if the goal is not 100% church attendance, you know, if the goal isn't getting people to read their Bible, you know, these are all good things, but they're not the goal. The goal is to be disciples of Jesus. And how do you get people to be disciples of Jesus? Well, there is no magic guarantee way to force people. You can only influence them to follow Jesus and to make that decision for themselves. And it's very much the same way with children. And so I use this expression. Our job as parents is to train the will of the child. That's where self-control resides. It's not in the feelings. Feelings are the enemy of self-control. The impulses and whims that just pop in our head, you don't have to teach children that. It just comes quite naturally to them. And we can encourage and foster that, or we can retard that by teaching them self-control. But that's what we really need to work on. And so it's a matter of the will. So you're always working on their will. It's not the yard work. It's not the trash. It's the will. And once you understand that, it helps you in everything you do as a parent. Because when you ask them to take the trash out, you really have two purposes in doing that. You want the trash out of your house, right? That's just a practical thing. But in having them take the trash out, I mean, after all, you could take the trash out, right? So why don't you do it? You just lazy? Or do you think it's helpful? They might learn something from this, right? But what are they going to learn from it? Well, they're going to learn how heavy the trash bag is or how messy it is. No, there are some practical things they can learn about taking the trash out and why that's important. But ultimately, you're trying to train their will. You're trying to impact their will. And the reason that's important is I know a lot of parents that tell their kids to take the trash out. And you know what a very common scenario of Johnny taking the trash out looks like? Why do I have to take the trash out? Nobody else has to take the trash out. I always have to take the trash out. And they grab the bag and they drag it out and whoom, stomping their feet, slam the door, they take the trash out. Did they do what they were told? Yes, they did. And a lot of parents say, yeah, got them to take the trash out. I won. I'm a victory parent. All right. Did we train their will in that process? Or did we actually strengthen their self-will and teach them, encourage them to be defiant and absorbed about self? In which case, yes, we may have gotten the trash out of the house, but that's minor compared to the battle we lost, which is we've actually taught them to be more selfish and drifting further from the Lord rather than being less selfish and learning how to control that self like they should. And that's why the fifth commandment is honor your father and mother, not obey them when they say take out the trash. Is a child who takes the trash out grumbling and stomping his feet and complaining, is he honoring his father and his mother? No. Because it's his will that has to be impacted, and that's what is remaining untouched or affected for the worse in many common scenarios in the home. And so if teaching wisdom and giving them practice in taking responsibility is an essential part of self-control, then we could say that imparting instruction and giving them practice in such things is the counterpart of how we go about training the will. We need to teach them some things, both verbally and the lives that we live, and we need to give them practice, give them occasions, like taking the trash out, to practice these things. But in doing so, we know that we're always practicing the will, not taking the trash out. And so we don't accept taking the trash out with a disrespectful attitude and stomping the feet and so on, because we're training the will, and we want to see to it that they, you know, do that, you know, properly, right? So the proper application of this method, then, There are three critical things. The parental control at some point has to become self-control. Instruction has to become insight, and discipline has to become self-discipline. This is just taking each one of those three things. And at the beginning, when our children are very small, just a month old, a year old, we have to do everything for them. They can't say no for themselves. We have to say no for them. They don't understand anything. And so all the wisdom is in our head. And we start teaching them, even when they're very small. And any discipline that they have is we're doing it for them. And that's obviously on the one extreme. But when they become 18, by that time, their wills need to have been fully developed where they are children who are in self-control, really adults who have self-control. It's no longer their parents' understanding, but it's their own understanding that they have learned and accepted and made their own faith. And it's no longer about parental discipline and imposing certain behaviors, but it is their own choice about how to behave. And so I use the term strong-willed child to describe this person. Now, most people use that phrase to describe a self-willed child and what is really a weak-willed child. Because this self-willed child who just has these impulses and these feelings and he wants what he wants and he wants it right now, he has no strength of true will. He's dominated by his feelings. And so we really should say a self-willed child in that case. But we all are really aiming for strong-willed children. We're trying to strengthen their godly will, where they are able to say no to what is wrong, to say yes to what is right, to say yes to what is hard, and that only by this process are we going to attain both things, godliness and independence. And so if we are so controlling of our children that it never becomes their own understanding, it never becomes their own practice, their own choice, their own self-control, we have failed. Even though outwardly it may appear like they're good. They're always taking the trash out with a smile on their face. But it's still not self-control, you see. And then obviously if we've given them a great deal of independence and they make all their own decisions, but they're foolish choices and they're godless decisions, then we have failed as well. And so with these two together, an understanding that we're constantly training the will to, at some point, and over time, gradually more and more each day, each year, they take more responsibility for self, so that the control is transitioning from parent to self, the understanding is transitioning from parent to self, the discipline is transitioning from, you know, parent to self. And so that's our job, is to provide strong-willed children. And we do that not so much by manipulating the outside, the externals. Those are there. Those are important. But we have to affect the inside, the will, the heart of the child. And that's where the real work of parenting is done. Well, let's take a 5-minute break here. If you'd like to stretch your legs, go to the water fountain, something like that. You've been so kind and patient as we've sat through that. And you can be thinking about some of the things we've said, and if you have any questions when we come back, we'll see if we'll entertain some of those. So hopefully we can get it into our head that we want to strengthen the will of our child. Some of you may have heard the story of the Native American grandfather teaching his grandson that in every man are two wolves. And the one wolf has all these noble traits of courage and bravery and so on. The other wolf is, envy and, hate. And little boy's eyes get big and it was a wolf. Well, in this great battle that these two wolves are locked in, which one's going to win? And the grandfather says, the one that you feed. And there's a lot of wisdom in that, of course. And that's true of the wills that are at conflict within us. There's a will that all of us have to do the right thing, and there's that will just to do what we want and to be selfish. And which one's going to win? Well, basically the one you feed, the one that you nurture, And sadly, there are a lot of parents that encourage and nurture and feed the self-will of their children. And even if we do it unintentionally, we are really making life so much more difficult for our children. And it may be that they have strength of character, that they're able to overcome this in life, but it's going to be so much more of a struggle for them. We're making it so much more difficult for them than if we taught them strength of character earlier on. Because we all develop habits, and the more deeply ingrained these habits, these weaknesses are, the more difficult they are to overcome. They're not impossible to overcome, but why would we want to make life more difficult for our children? We just don't want to do that. And that's the problem with this notion some people have. Well, I just respect my child as an individual, so I'm going to let them make their own decision. Well, at what point are they capable even of making a decision? Maybe when they're 9 or 10 or whatever. But by that time, their life has been dominated by all of these impulses and desires that they've given into that have taken hold on their life that they can't really make a free choice. And so we do need to make decisions for them. We need to say, no, you can't play in the street. No, you can't have ice cream for breakfast every day. No, these things are foolish. These things are wrong. And again, if we're just constantly telling no for them and that never becomes their own ability to say no to themselves, that's not a good thing. But the only choice we have, we can't choose not to tell them no. That's not an option. So we have to tell them no in such a way that it transitions to their own no. And so we want to talk about that balance between the two. And the second session is kind of focusing on parenting styles, looking at these two extremes of kind of a hands-off parenting that doesn't have any rules, doesn't impose any control on the child, just leaves the kid to themselves, and how that's going to turn out, versus a parent who's very controlling, very imposing, but we'll see again how that turns out. And neither one is correct. And we have to find that balance again where parental control is exercised, but it is transitioned appropriately and in time to self-control. And our instruction becomes their own insight and understanding. And our discipline and training of them becomes their own self-discipline. So that's what we're aiming for. And again, I just think if we don't learn anything else this weekend, but that's the big picture. That's what it is I'm doing as a parent. That everything boils down to this. And so every specific decision you have to make, you know, this statement I'm about to make to my child, this act that I'm about to ask them to do, this thing I'm about to do for them, if you evaluated every interaction you had with your child with this question, is this action more likely to strengthen their will to do the right thing, or is it more likely to make them more self-willed? And if you could ask that question, now again, it would be cumbersome and tedious to actually ask that question every single time, but if on some level we're conditioning ourselves to give thought to that, are we heading in the direction of self-will here by what we're doing, or are we heading in the direction of a strong will in accordance with what God wants? And again, it takes some wisdom to understand that. I'm not saying, okay, should my kid play Xbox? Well, on the surface of that, you could say, well, that's just a complete indulgence. I'm just teaching my kid to have fun and exercise his selfish desires. Well, but, you know, we are to enjoy things in life. And if you restrict him and he's never exposed anything like that, there's a greater likelihood that the time he's 18, he's out of the house, he might just be a Xbox raving lunatic because he never got to, right? Never seen a TV in his life. And so now all he can do is sit in front of one and vegetate. You don't want that. And so better to say, learn how to enjoy things in life with restraint, within reason. There's a time and place for that. We do things we enjoy, but we need to learn how to say no to overindulging ourselves and knowing where to draw the lines and things like that. And so, yes, we may make the decision to let them do this fun thing. Yeah, we may go to Disney World. I'm not saying that's a sin because, oh, that just inherently teaches kids to be self-centered. it can be used as a tool to teach kids actually to be, you know, less self-centered if we handle it correctly. So a couple of things I want to talk about before we go to our breakout. Some essential factors that have to be part of this parenting process. And this gets us to thinking about some of those parenting styles we'll be talking about in the second session. But first of all, it takes time and experience. Now, some people can never have children and you adopt teenagers and you're just kind of thrown into the lion's den. But mostly it appears that God's normal way of doing things is we as young parents have little babies and we're kind of learning how to be parents as they're learning how to grow up and be people. And so our on-the-job training and learning as we go along is okay because, you know, they don't start out as teenagers, you know, fortunately, right? And so experience, you know, our level of inexperience is kind of commiserate with their level of inexperience, and so it seems to work out pretty well. But what I'm emphasizing is parenting is a process that happens over years, even though it's still a short period of time. And it takes time. And Deuteronomy chapter 6 is a passage we need to particularly take to heart. Verse 7, you know, Moses has said in verse 6, "These words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart. But not only that, you shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up." So basically, just constantly, you know, day to day, as you're interacting with your children, you're taking advantage of those opportunities to teach them. And I think there's a very important principle here. You know, what are we doing in our interactions with our children unless we are teaching them? And we're always teaching them something. And we may simply be teaching them that it's important to just vegetate in front of a TV and not talk to each other as family members. Well, that's not a very good lesson. And so we have a conscious choice we can make about how we spend the time we do have with our children and whether we're focusing on training the will. It's always about training the will. You know, we're going to be spending the next half hour with our kids. What are we going to be doing that's going to help strengthen their will in the way that God would want it to be? And it's going to be hard work. Almost by definition, the easy way is always the wrong way. The easy way is the way of sin. The easy way is the broad way that leads to destruction. That's true in parenting as it is in other spiritual things. And so it takes effort. And only those parents that are really going to do the hard thing, and you can see how this works. Only a parent who has self-control themselves and can say no to the easy way, to say no to the self-indulgent thing. I just want to sit here and watch a ball game. I just want to sit here and do nothing. I've been working all day at the office. I don't want to do anything. But if you have self-control as a parent, you say, it's not about me. It's not how I feel. It's about my child and how I have an opportunity to mold and shape them and affect their will. That's what I'm going to do, and it's going to take some effort, and we just need to realize that. And consistency is critical. I mean, everybody will tell you that. You need to be consistent. Even if you're a lenient parent, if you're consistently lenient, that's better than if you're inconsistently severe. In fact, some parents think that you make up for being inconsistent the more strict or severe you are. And that just makes people into sociopaths. That's probably the worst possible combination. So, you know, if you're not going to be strict with your children, then at least be consistently lax. Rather than just, you know, getting frustrated and cracking down on them, you know, every now and then. They won't know what to expect. You know, what side of the bed did Mom get up on today? You know, what planet is Dad from, you know, this week? You're confused, and you don't know what the rules are, and you're just frustrated. And so consistency is very important. Consistency is important if for no other reason than that here we are trying to tell kids, these are the rules. These are the laws of life. You know, we might teach them about the law of gravity. Well, we don't sound like we know very much about the law of gravity if all of a sudden There really is no such thing as law of gravity. And, you know, it works one day, doesn't work the next day. And, well, that's not how it is. The law of gravity is the law of gravity. And so our kids learn about that. And it's a very important rule, and they need to learn to accommodate themselves to that law. And here we are teaching them some moral laws and saying, these are the laws, these are the rules. Really? Well, if those are the rules, then they're the same rules today as they were yesterday and will be tomorrow. But suddenly, because, well, you know, we know it's not really necessary, you know. Now, most parents think their kids shouldn't be playing on the interstate. They think it's a bad idea, right? Don't play in the street. And why do most parents really draw a line there? Most parents don't have a problem with their kids playing in the street because they absolutely know that's not going to happen. That's absolutely no. I got to draw a line there. I will not tolerate this. But then they say, well, don't take cookies before supper. Well, they're not going to get hit by a truck doing that, right? They're not going to die doing that. And so I know that rule is not as important to their physical existence as not playing in the street. But if it's a rule and it's a moral principle and we insist they live by that and accommodate themselves to that, then we should enforce that rule and be consistent about it and not have it be a rule one day and not a rule another day, because that just completely undermines our credibility and our authority. Because what our kids are looking for is, do my parents really know what's going on? Because I don't. I want to know what the rules are. I want to know what life is about. And here are two people God has put in my life to tell me, can I really believe what they say? And you have a lot of kids saying, no, I can't, because one day they say this, and it seems to be really important, and then next week, it's not so important anymore. And then the next week, it's back to being important. I don't think they know what they're doing. I don't think they have a clue any more than I do. And you can imagine how insecure and frustrating that would be for a child. And all children are going to test the rules, because the one thing they want to know, is that really a rule? Is that really the way life works? And we're not doing our children a favor when we teach them, no, that's not really a rule. You know, it's important that we say it's a rule, but not really, you know. And so consistency is just critical. And finally, we have to have the heart of our child. Again, you can hold a gun to everybody's head and make them come to church, but have you changed their heart? Well, you might have made it worse. But the only way to change a person on the inside is if they let you, right? You got a coworker whose life's a complete mess. Can you help him? If he will let you. If you've developed a relationship with him enough, he trusts you. He looks at your life and says, boy, you got something I don't have. I'd like that. I want that kind of marriage. I want that kind of family. I want that kind of peace, you know. And they'll open their heart to you and let you help them. But if their heart's closed to you, it's impervious. There's not a thing you can do. And that's true of our children. And so they naturally come to us and give us their heart. They're just kind of born that way. And we as parents can do things that will close that heart down. And our children can even get to the point where they will not allow us in their life at all. Or we can do things to nurture that openness and maintain that trust and even build that trust. And as long as we have their heart, we are going to be able to train the will. Remember, that's the goal, train the will. Now, if my goal is to get the trash out, my son might be the most hardened criminal and hateful person and his heart be completely rock solid. I can't get in at all. But as long as I got a gun and I can make him take the trash out, but I'm not training his will. I'm not affecting his heart. And I can't delude myself into thinking I'm parenting him, right? And so it's all about the inside. Now, the externals are important. We want them taking the trash out. We want them learning right behaviors. We want them doing the right things. But it has to grow out of their heart being what it's supposed to be, their will being shaped and molded the way God wants it to be. And so, you know, we know this is a biblical principle because all problems are heart problems. You know, Jesus makes this point in Matthew chapter 15. you know, in the question about what defiles a person and so on, do you not understand that everything that goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is eliminated? Things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those defile the man. Out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders, and so on. And, you know, you can think of all these passages in the Bible that talk about the heart being the very, you know, wellspring of life, and, you know, the who we are as people, it resides here in the very heart of who we are. And so the heart is the center of the person. The will, particularly, is that part of us that chooses, and that's the part that's the most important, not how we feel, but what we choose. And so, because we were created for a relationship, you know, we seek that. Nobody truly wants to be just completely isolated and have no human contact. We were built for relationship. We were built to give our hearts to people, to reciprocate that relationship of love and trust together. And so our child wants to give their heart to somebody. And the most natural people to give their heart to are those who make up their immediate family, their mom and dad and their siblings. And so your child's going to give his heart to somebody. And if you have such a relationship with your child that you have closed his heart down to you, he's going to turn to somebody else and give his heart to them. And that's why gangs are so popular. You know, people don't find any sense of family or community in their own physical home. They have no father, no mother. You know, where do you look for community? Where do you look for a place to belong? Who are you going to give your heart to? And so the person that possesses your child's heart is the one who has his life and his loyalty. And so, yeah, that's why it's so critical that what we do is to keep the heart of our child open to us, to earn their trust and maintain that trust and build that trust. And how this is going to lead into our second session here is we're going to talk about these parenting styles. And we have these two extremes, this hands-off, no rules kind of approach. And as we will see, that leads to the child's disrespect of the parent and the child concluding this parent doesn't know what they're doing and they have no confidence in the parent. And so a child can close his heart off for that reason. There's no point having anything to do with these people. They don't know what they're doing. And then you have this other extreme, this very authoritarian, controlling, imposing externals upon the child. And again, how's that going to affect the heart? Except to close it down and turn our children's hearts away from us. So we got to find that balance where we're exercising authority, but in a way that does not close down our child's heart and keeps faith with that child and builds trust and will lead us to the opportunity of changing and molding the will of that child over the time that we have with them. So we'll conclude this session at that point and break, I think Adam has...